So what will you be doing at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon? What will you be doing at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon? I'm sure some will be sleeping. I'm sure some will wish they were sleeping. I'm sure some will still be eating. But hands up if you think you'll be listening to our Queen in some shape or form. Who thinks they'll be listening, watching the Queen? Brilliant. That's what we do, isn't it? 3 o'clock, Christmas afternoon. It's one of those moments when we know together what we'll be doing. And as Carrie mentioned, the prayers. We have rejoiced in recent years, haven't we, at the clear Christian voice that she has brought to that particular occasion. The Queen's Christmas message is important to us. But of course, our homes are full of messages at Christmas time, aren't they? Greetings from friends we never see. Greetings from people we shall see today and tomorrow. But above all, it's the round robin, isn't it? Those perfect photos of the perfect holiday. Including, of course, the perfect children who have enjoyed perfect success in everything that they've done through the past year. Because what you're looking at is a picture, or many pictures, in colour, of the perfect family. Some of us love them. Some of us hate them. Some of us are completely indifferent to them. My mum, when we go down to Devon tomorrow, will be thrilled when Suzanne takes those that from people she knows. But what we're going to look at this morning from Hebrews is a message more important than those from friends and family, a message more important even than that from the Queen. What we've got here in Hebrews 1 is God's Christmas message to us. So why is this message so important? You'll find some headings on the order of service. You can follow those through. You'll see where we're going from that. So the first reason why this message is so important is because God makes promises to his people. Long ago, at many times and in various ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. The God of the Bible is a speaking God. You open the first page of the Bible and he's there speaking, isn't he? Creation came into being by his word. He spoke and everything that has been created, even the things we know nothing about yet, everything that was created came into being. He spoke and called a people to himself. He spoke and told them what was required in order to be his people. And then he spoke to tell them what would be coming, what the future would hold. And we heard one of those messages from Isaiah a little earlier. The hope of future rescue, the hope of a future king who would sit on David's throne, the hope of one who would bring not just Israel, but the whole world back to himself. We have a God who speaks. We have a God who amazingly makes promises to people. Now you may think that's actually the wrong way round. You think surely it's up to us to make promises to God. Surely we should be saying to God as we come to the end of 1 year and head into another, I'm going to do better next year. I promise to give more time and more money. I promise to pray and read my Bible more. I promise to think about you more in 2018. And of course, in a religious world, the answer would be yes, that's exactly what you'd expect. Do more, try harder. But that's not the Bible world. Grace is the watchword of the Bible. God freely speaks promises of hope to his people. God keeps his promises to us, that we may be his people, and for some of us who haven't yet, that we may become his people. So Will you listen? That's the question. Will you listen to the word God speaks? Will you listen to his promise? What do we do with promises? Well, we either believe them, disbelieve them, or we ignore them. What will you do with the promise this Christmas? Maybe you have yet to believe it. Maybe you've yet to say yes to this Jesus. Maybe you need to turn away from that religiosity which tells you to do more and try harder, that keeps saying you're the one who's got to make the promises to God. And maybe you've just got to ask him to help you to hear his promise to you. His promise of grace and life. And maybe all of us just need a greater confidence in the promises of God. We live in a world that thinks little of them, that despises and mocks them. We need a greater confidence as we prepare to go back to school and office and workplace in the new year. A greater confidence to live for Jesus, a greater confidence to speak this message about Jesus to those we live and work amongst. Because this Christmas message is for everybody. God makes promises to his people. And the second thing we need to know is that this promise from God is a promise about his final word, Jesus. Verse 2. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by his word of power. Now, the people to whom this letter is written had gone through some very tough times, some real opposition, but those days were over. And if you turn over the page to chapter 2, you'll see why this letter was needed. Because in these easier times, they were in danger. Well, let's look, see what our author says. Verse 1 of chapter 2. Therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. They are in danger of drifting away from the message of salvation because the days are easier. And the hand of compromise is now disguised as the hand of friendship. People who had opposed them are now saying things to them like, don't let those old divisions go on keeping us apart. Come back. Come back to the old ways. Yes, of course, keep Jesus in mind, but come back. Now, those old ways, the old religion, of course, is that of the Old Testament. The word that they were believing was the word of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It was the world of temples and high priests and sacrifice. It was a great word for then. It was a great word for those days. It was just the word that was needed, a word that pointed forward to Jesus. But notice how our author says. He says, long ago, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, there's a contrast. There's a then and a now going on here. I don't know how you deal with your tax sort of affairs and things, but it's something I really struggle with, and I was very grateful when I was put in touch with a guy who lives somewhere. I'm not sure where he lives, but I phone him up once a year. And it's one of those things I dread, never look forward to doing it, think it's going to be awful, but he's just really good. He just tells me what to do and what to write in various boxes, and these days I think he even does that for me. I don't have to do anything at all, really. It's great. But imagine that you were having a conversation with whoever it is who looks after your tax. You said, and he says, look, I've got a great idea. I've found a way that we can minimize your tax requirements for the year. And again, most of us will probably go, terrific, won't we? He says, what you need to do is to brick up all your windows. Because that window tax is killing us, isn't it? We need to deal with that. Brick your windows up and I've reduced your tax bill by half. And you'll say, yeah, but just a minute. That was the sort of, that may have been in the accountant's tax manual for 1723, but it's not much help now. After all, the window tax was abolished in 1851. What are you talking about? I want to know about offshore tax havens. That's what I need to know about. useless. Good for then, but no good for today. It was for another time. That advice cannot help you now. And that's exactly what our author is saying. Make sure you're listening to the right word. But he's also saying to us, look how much greater is this word. It's greater because of the Jesus that it speaks about. He is God's Son. He is the heir of all things. Everything belongs to him because he created it. The future is his. And he is God. Look at verse 3, the beginning of verse 3. You can't get any more God-like than he is because he is God. If you want to know what God is like, you look to Jesus. And there may be some of us who are much more comfortable with the idea of God than the idea of Jesus. But what our author is saying to us here is that you can't have one without the other. If you want God, you must have Jesus. You see God when you look at Jesus. And notice his present activity. He upholds the universe by his word of power. He didn't just make it by his word. He sustains it by his word. It continues because of his words. So the universe continues today because of that word. The earth moves around the sun at that sort of amazing point whereby life can be here by his word. You've taken that last breath you've just taken because of his word. That's what sustaining means. So of course we're going to pay closer attention to this word, aren't we? Look at the one it's about. He is so much greater. But we'd be foolish not to recognize that there are many other words that would distract us, that would call us away from this word. Words that cannot help us. Sort of religious institutional words that would say, no, it is about rites and rituals. It is about trying harder and doing more. Words from our culture, summed up so well by David Cameron when he said, get with the program, to church leaders some years ago. My experience is a constant threat, isn't it? Don't you find that? That word that says to me, well, of course, that relationship will be just fine. It can't do any harm. It's just a bit of fun. Don't worry. Everyone's looking at that website. Didn't do them any harm. And yes, of course, you're free to exchange your overdraft. Take out another loan. After all, that man on the sunny advert looks so friendly and nice, doesn't he? It must be all right. And my reason says to me, how can you possibly believe in the 21st century that a virgin conceived and gave birth to a son? That's just an excuse for bad behavior, surely. So many words, so many influences that will cause us to drift away. And the really dangerous thing about drifting is that you don't really notice it's happening. It's so sort of restful and so peaceful, and you just gently drift away. And our author says the way to stop that, to make sure you don't do that, is to stick with Jesus, God's final word, his word for these last days. This word about our great salvation, this word about his great Son. Don't drift, our author says. Pay closer attention to Jesus, God's final word. But this Christmas message is also important because it's about God's promise that Jesus has finished his work. The end of verse 3. After making purification for sins, Jesus sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Now the temptation in chapter 2 and verse 1 was to drift away from this great salvation. Verse 3, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? In other words, we're looking for other ways to purify ourselves from our sins. We often hear today, don't we, of the need to forgive yourself, to accept yourself as the person that you are. Don't be weighed down by guilt or expectation. You are who you are. Forgive yourself. Make peace with yourself. Accept that. Love yourself. But there are those who undertake what in previous generations we'd have called penances, such as David Walliams did when he swam the Channel to make atonement for his sins. Some try, and they will be next week undoubtedly, to turn over a new leaf in the hope that the new me will tip the balance in the scales of justice against the old me. Our author says, don't drift into such futile thinking. Reject such works and look to the work that brings you full and complete forgiveness, the death of Jesus on the cross. Throughout the book, our author will talk to us about Jesus as the great high priest, the one who makes the once and for all offering of himself for the sins, for the guilt of the world. And having made that offering, verse 3 tells us, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Sitting down here is a picture of completion. The task was finished. All that was needed to be done was accomplished. Everything that could be done had been done. And it was a success. Therefore, Jesus sat down. It's like the end of the day when finally the children are in bed and all is quiet. Or maybe it's like the end of the day over Christmas when finally the children and the grandchildren have gone home and all is quiet. That's the moment to sit down. That's the moment to relax, isn't it? Maybe it's like the end of the project, a project that has been years in the planning and the preparation and the execution. Imagine the celebration, the sitting down there'll be once Crossrail is finished. Not just for commuters, but for those who've been involved. Imagine people involved from the very start in that project. What a celebration, what a sitting down there'll be when that is done. Here Jesus is pictured as sitting down. Here Jesus is the one who has completed the task that only he could possibly have taken on. In chapter 10 of Hebrews, we read these words. When Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. Well, if you're not yet a Christian as you sit here this morning, then please hear this message. Please hear this word of God, a word of forgiveness and new life. All that is awaiting you in Jesus, and because of his finished work. If we change the image for a moment, we might say that the present is bought, it's wrapped, it's sitting under the tree, it's just waiting for you to receive it and open it. That's all you have to do. There's no other present. There's no other salvation. There's no other way to find forgiveness, purification for sins, an end to guilt. No other way at all. Jesus has done it all. So why deny yourself this gift? Why deny others by not speaking more confidently of the Jesus who has won this gift for us? Our author says, don't drift. Pay closer attention to Jesus and his finished work. Jesus then is God's final word. Jesus has finished God's work of salvation. Why then is it so important that we keep these two things together? And with this, we will conclude. These days, in any industry, any business, there are people charged with making sure that the regulations are understood and that you as a business are compliant with those regulations. Governance is a key word. It's a big thing these days. And of course, it's not only a big thing. It's an ever-growing and an ever-changing thing. Shelves and shelves and shelves of government directives telling you what the next thing is you've got to be doing. Desks upon desks of people employed to make sure that you do. And as you will know, there's more data protection stuff coming in May that's going to apply to charities as well. Governance and compliance, it's the big thing. Well, what if we were to apply that principle to salvation? That's a big thing too. But what if it were also an ever-changing and an ever-growing thing? In other words, what if there were heavenly directives that came out every couple of weeks, every few years, every millennia or so? What if those who devised the medieval system of purgatory and indulgences were just acting on the latest of those heavenly directives? In his magnificent book on the Reformation, Dermot McCulloch describes how the Abbey of Sion in southwest London encouraged ordinary churchgoers, rich and poor alike, to use a set of 5 beads to remind them of Jesus' death, as well as a 33-word poem, one word for each year of Jesus' life, in their devotion. He goes on to say this: the user would also have to repeat every day for a year the Lord's Prayer 15 times and the Hail Mary 15 times. That would ensure 5,475 years off one's time in purgatory, since 15 times 36, 365 days of the year, adds up to 5,475. Some advertising blurbs attached to the prayer promised that this action would also liberate 15 deceased relatives from purgatory, convert 15 sinners to a good life, and sustain 15 other relatives in virtue. McCulloch adds, altogether value for effort. How could Martin Luther and the other reformers know that this was wrong? How could they know this was wrong if they didn't have a final word in Jesus and assurance that the work of salvation was completed? Maybe these guys were giving us God's latest word in what it was required to be saved. Maybe those today who would tell us that, well, of course, everyone's going to be saved because God's kind and loving and generous and he wants everybody to be with him in heaven. Maybe that's the latest angelic email and some of us haven't got it yet. Where's the assurance that we're listening to the right words? Where's the assurance we're trusting in the right work? That's why this message in Hebrews 1 is so vitally important for us this Christmas and every Christmas. That's why we must heed the warning not to drift away. Because there are no more words from God. Jesus has completed the work of salvation. There is nothing left to do. And the writer of the Hebrews wants us to have a right and godly confidence in what we believe. So he urges us in chapter 3 to hold our original confidence firm to the end. He says to us in chapter 10, draw near to God with a true heart in full assurance of faith. And again in chapter 10, he wants us to hold fast the confession of our faith without wavering. For he who promised is faithful. We have this confidence because of the one who made the promise. The one whose message this is. Jesus is God's final word. Jesus has finished God's work of salvation. A message that brings hope and assurance to the church and to the world. God's Christmas message.